This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Every 10 years, census forms make their way into the mailboxes of every household in America, seeking information on America's basic demographic questions. Some homes, though, receive the long-form questionnaire, and they are the ones responsible for informing the government about everything from their occupations and incomes to what sort of fuel heats their homes. But what do the answers on millions of forms really add up to? Well, Sam Roberts knows. He's a reporter, columnist, and editor at the New York Times, and the author of a new book called Who We Are Now, The Changing Face of America in the 21st Century. His book mines the 2000 census for a comprehensive look at how the American population at the turn of the century compares to that in decades past, and how it is likely to change in the future. Do you live in Elliott, Kentucky? Elliott County, Kentucky? What about the city of Warren, Michigan? If you do, we'd like to hear from you. Can you guess why? The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Call us from one of those places, and we'll tell you, or we'll put you on the air and talk to you about that, and then we'll tell everybody why we were asking. We'd also like to hear from other listeners who've noticed changes in their communities. Is your neighborhood getting more diverse? Either ethnically, economically, or even generationally. Join the conversation. Again, our number is 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Sam Roberts joins us from our New York Bureau. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Joe.
So let's start out with the family. I don't know if you heard the very start of the show, but there's this old image of, you know, Leave It to Beaver, the nuclear family, mom and pop and two kids. Is there such a thing anymore that's typical like that?
Well, it's not typical anymore. It's still fairly common. The important thing to remember is that the family structure in this country has always been changing, and it's now going through another evolution, as I point out in the book. It's astounding, though, that if you look at all the households in the country, that typical Leave It to Beaver family, the married couple, children, a stay-at-home mom, now account for only 7% of all households in the country, a astonishingly low figure. Again, that has changed for a number of reasons. People are getting married later. Moms are working outside the home. People are living longer. Therefore, there are going to be more people living alone after one spouse may have died. There are a lot of pressures on that relationship that are causing it to change, and indeed they have. In the 1990s, it was fascinating when I was researching this how much had changed just in that one decade. That for the first time there are now more people living alone than there are married couples with kids.
Wow. So if a mom at home with the father working and two kids accounts for 7%, is there a family unit? Now, you've just said that living alone, I guess that's a unit of a new sort, but is there a family unit that is the most common?
Well, I guess if you looked at families as opposed to households, and these are all these kind of arcane census definitions that I tried to not dwell on and look more at the broader trends, but married, most people still get married. Most people still get married and have kids. But it is a lot less common than it ever used to be. And people are marrying later. They're having fewer kids. It's interesting. I interviewed Calvin Butts, who's a preacher at Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York. And he was saying that a number of prospective couples have come to him and said, do we have to go through this till death do us part in our vows? I mean, let's be honest, whoever lasts that long. And in fact, they're right statistically that more marriages are now ending in divorce than in death. Well, Reverend Butt said to them, you want to do that, go find another preacher. Hmm. He was sticking by the rules. But in fact, most people don't do that anymore.
You know, it does seem to me that it's been a while now since we've talked about the epidemic of divorce. Do the census figures show that that is still on the increase, or have we peaked and started to come down?
It is still on the increase, but much more slowly. If you look back, and one of the things I tried to do in the book was place all of this in some sort of perspective. In 1900, maybe about 1 in 100 Americans were divorced. In 2000, about 1 in 10 adult Americans were divorced. Those numbers are starting to level off a little bit. perhaps because people are marrying later, perhaps because they're living together more before they're getting married and a little more sure of themselves, perhaps because they're more mature when they get married, but they do seem to be leveling off somewhat.
And when there is divorce, is it clear still which parent is getting the children, or is that changing?
Well, for the most part, it is the mother. The number of single moms, either because of divorce or moms who never got married, still going up substantially. Most black kids today are being raised by single mothers, not in two-parent families. Usually, they are going with the mother, but there are a growing number, still very small, but growing number of fathers who are heading single-parent families.
Okay. If you remember, I threw out this query to the audience and asked for calls from Warren, Michigan. Near Warren, anyway. And so let's go to Annette in Rochester Hills, Michigan, which, Annette, I take it Rochester Hills is just down the road from Warren?
It's about 35 minutes away.
35 minutes. All right. Well, we'll call that close enough. Can you guess what is significant about Warren, Michigan, which is, I guess, near Detroit? Is that right?
Yeah, it's Metro Detroit.
So can you guess, first of all, why I was interested or why I brought up this issue of Warren, Michigan?
People are still moving to Warren as opposed to moving out of it.
Well, not quite. Would you say that's the most, I'll give you one more try. Would you say that the people in Warren are fairly stable, or is there a lot of,
No, they stay. I have friends who've grown up there, parents who've been there, parents of friends who've been there and have no intention of ever leaving.
Okay, well, that's just about it. Annette, I'm going to thank you for that call, and I'm going to go to Mustafa in Warren, Michigan. Mustafa, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon.
So if I said that Warren, Michigan had a special role in the census, would you guess what it was?
Is it because of having different communities there, different backgrounds?
No, actually. Okay, I think Annette was a little closer, but I'll tell you what it is. I mean, and I take this from the book, Sam Roberts, but according to your book anyway, Warren, Michigan is the county or the city with the longest home ownership on average, more than three decades, as opposed to people moving, I guess the average length of living in a house now is, what, about 6 years? Is that right, Sam Roberts?
That's right, Joe. It's about 6 years. And in Warren, Michigan, maybe one in five people have been living in the same house for at least three decades. And that's just about a record for the entire United States.
So, Mustafa, how long have you lived in Warren?
5 years.
5 years.
Yes.
And are you surprised when I tell you that people...
Very much, yes.
Really? So you think that it's been more changing than that?
You know, when you go to get mortgage, they always tell you that you're not going to stay in your house for more than 5 years. You're going to move from house. So that is the background in everyone's mind.
Really? Really? But you think... Can you see yourself staying in Warren for 30 years?
Definitely, yes.
Okay.
Because of the school system.
Ah. All right. Well, Mustafa, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Well, Joe, one of the reasons for that is that there are a disproportionate number of elderly people in Warren. I guess Mustafa not among them, but about almost one in five people in the population now 65 and over in Warren. People who grew up there, people who raised kids there, and people for whatever reason see no reason to pack off and go to Florida or retire somewhere else.
We're talking with Sam Roberts about his new book, Who We Are Now. It's a book that tries to make sense of the census and also paint a picture of the trends in geography and social marriage, wealth, immigration that this country has undergone in the last 100 years. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And we also would like to get your emails at totn@npr.org. And I'll remind you that we're hoping to get a call from Elliott County, Kentucky. We just heard from somebody in Warren, Michigan because of a strange thing that, or a significant number from Warren, Michigan about people staying in their homes very long. Elliott County is also distinguished for a particular reason, which we'll share with you, especially if we get a caller from that area. So please consider giving us a call from Kentucky. Let's talk a little bit about aging, Sam Roberts. Clearly, The population is aging. You mentioned it. The first baby boomers are about, they're only a few years away now from entering retirement. What's that going to mean?
Well, that has enormous implications, Joe, politically, economically, socially. As you say, in 2011, the first baby boomers will turn age 65, and that's going to be an enormous number of retirees, whether they retire right then or already have retired, moving through the system. By 2030, the rest of the country will look a lot like Warren, Michigan, in terms of age. About one in five Americans will be 65 and older. And, you know, even in this political campaign, much less in campaigns to come, you're going to see a cleavage over issues. You're going to see a older, whiter voting population and a younger, somewhat darker overall population with somewhat different agendas. The older people more interested, for the most part, in health care and Social Security. The younger, obviously interested in health care, too, but also schools and mass transit and daycare and other issues that the elderly may not put at the top of their agendas.
I wonder if this is a problem. I mean, as I gather, the fertility rates are going down in most industrialized countries, and the population is aging. But the United States has got a slight change for that because of immigration. What are the implications of that?
Well, Joe, that's exactly right. Who we are now is a country very unique in the world. And one of the things I did in this book that I hadn't done when I did the first book 10 years ago was look at America compared to the rest of the world. That certainly seemed for all sorts of reasons to be a lot more relevant. And only Australia and Canada among developed nations have the same kind of growth rate that this country has. If you look at Japan, if you look at Western and Northern Europe, they are aging rapidly. Italy now, more than 20% of the population to 65 or over. And the problem that creates, and that's why they're beginning to allow a little bit more immigration, why places like Japan are interested in letting women work more than ever before, is because you need a certain percentage of working age people to support the people who are too young to work and the people who have already retired. And those other countries, unlike the United States, are running into real problems in getting enough working age people.
Let's take a call now from Jessica in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling to talk about the change in perceptions on interracial relationships and interracial marriages. I started school, public school, here in Louisiana in the early 90s, beginning of the 90s, actually, and my school was unofficially segregated. There were classes with white students and classes with black students. We had recess at different times. We ate lunch at different times. By the time I was in high school, at the end of the 90s, the majority of the relationships my classmates around me were in were interracial because our school was finally officially segregated. The lawsuits have all finally ended. And the Baton Rouge school districts have all been desegregated officially, and we had the 50-50 minority-majority balance at the school that they were trying to establish elsewhere, and everyone seemed to just, I never heard a single comment from any student about the relationships being inappropriate or anything of that nature, and I know a lot of the people still, and a lot of them are married now and have children together or living together and have children together. And my roommate is a child of an interracial marriage, and he has been through a lot, and his family has been through a lot in the past.
Okay, Jessica, we're going to have to leave it there with that question, and I'll get Sam Roberts to address it when we come back after the break. We're talking with Sam Roberts, editor, reporter, and columnist at the New York Times. Based on the 2000 census, he sees great demographic changes for America during the 21st century. Do you? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking with Sam Roberts of the New York Times about his new book, Who We Are Now, The Changing Face of America in the 21st Century. and we're talking about what the 2000 census can tell us about who we are now. Has your community changed? Have you just moved to a new community? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Sam Roberts, the last caller, was speaking about integration and segregation. Do the numbers bear her out? Is the country really moving toward a more integrated pattern?
Joe, it is incredibly so. Of course, there's still a great deal of housing segregation, and housing segregation influences where people go to school, and therefore there's still a fair amount of school segregation, at least de facto segregation. But one of the things that's amazing that I discovered in doing the book is that if you go back as recently as 1950, there was only one state outside the South, Arizona, that had a population that was more than 10% non-white. By 2000, the population of only 10 states in the entire country were less than 10% non-white. And what you've seen even more so in the 1990s, and again, this is why I did a whole new book, is that you've had so much immigration coming into this country, and you've had so much dispersal of people that people are moving to lots of places. The number of foreigners, the number of blacks, the number of Hispanics, the number of Asians who have spread to fairly remote regions of this country, much greater than it's ever been before. Not just in the centers where you might expect it, the cities you might expect it, but in the suburbs. There are Pakistani news dealers in Idaho. There are Indian deli owners in Iowa. Lots of people in different places, in part because of the mobility in the country, in part because of following jobs, in part because of a greater tolerance. And that has led to much more interracial relationship, not necessarily marriage, but just people even talking to each other. For the first time, people were allowed to describe themselves as multiracial on the census. Only about 5 million or so did that, but that clearly is the way lots of people are heading.
You know, one of the things, speaking of immigration, that you mentioned is that you can sort of see some of the changes by just looking at the surnames that are popular in this country. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's interesting. Smith is still the most common surname in the United States. I guess many of us descended from blacksmith somewhere long ago. But the top 50 surnames now include about seven or so Hispanic names: Garcia, Martinez, Rodriguez, Hernandez. And if you look around the country, in California in particular, among newborns, Hispanic babies are now a majority. Interestingly enough, not a majority for the first time, but a majority since the 1850s, when there were more Hispanics in California than so-called Anglos or Anglo-Saxons. And it just is further proof of the evolution of this country, that we're constantly changing. And that's why I tend to disagree with people like Pat Buchanan or Samuel Huntington, who see this move away from a European Anglo-Saxon tradition as something dangerous and frightening. I see it as part of a continuum that's been going on for a long time. You look in Texas, Jose is now the number one name among newborns in Texas. Lots of Mexicans, Mexican families of Mexican origin coming in there. But if you look in New York City, which is maybe a generation or so ahead, among Hispanic newborns, the most popular names are Ashley and Justin, a small but I think significant sign of how people are assimilating.
I am horrified. Ashley and Justin?
Yep, and for Asians, it's Michelle and Kevin.
Michelle and Kevin. Well, I mean, talk about being assimilated. My goodness. Well, I guess I'm. That's the most staggering statistic I've heard today.
Well, what could be more American than Joe and Sam?
Well, exactly. That's what. See, now we're talking, Joe and Sam. But I think Jose is just as good, actually. Anyway, let's never mind what I think. Let's take a call from Lawrence in Portland, Oregon. Lawrence, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm looking forward to reading the book. It sounds quite interesting. I have two questions. One is based on an experience I had, and I had somebody come to my door from the census, and he demanded, absolutely demanded, that I check the box that said Hispanic, and I'm not Hispanic, I'm Mexican, and I wanted to be reflected as being a Mexican homeowner, a Mexican business owner, and he just refused to allow me to put that down or even hand write it in. So that kind of discouraged me from wanting to participate in the census. And the other part of that is that I've heard historically that a large number of minorities do not participate in the census. And I wonder how that impacts the true image of our country. I do have one other question, if you can answer that one.
Okay, well, we'll see how we get with that one. Sam Roberts, what do you think?
Okay, two things. I don't think the census people are allowed to tell you how to fill out the form at all. They do a lot of mathematical tricks, extrapolation, and various things like that, but you're supposed to do the census form as a matter of self-identification, which, again, is why it's not always 100% accurate. People can identify themselves any way they want, but no one is supposed to tell you how to fill out that form. You're right, there has been an undercount in the census traditionally, and the groups that have been undercounted most are new immigrants, blacks, Hispanics, poorer people. The census did a much better job in 2000, in part helped by localities to count, and I think it's probably came a lot closer to the actual count than ever before.
Okay, and you had another question, Lawrence?
Yes, in your research on the census, did you find significant separation between the number of Anglo police officers opposed to minorities throughout the country? And is there any particular area that is more balanced or has a larger number of minority police officers?
The census doesn't go into that breakdown as specifically, but I think you can check that probably through various other databases, whether the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department. I think you will find places that have growing numbers of Latino, Hispanic police officers, black police officers, probably Detroit, probably places in Texas as well where the Hispanic population much greater, probably Dade, Miami, where the Hispanic population is also substantially high. Excuse me. Those probably the most likely places, and also Arizona, New Mexico, where they are high as part of the general population.
Okay. Let's take a call from Krabby in Sandy Hook, Kentucky. Krabby, welcome to the program.
Hello. Hello.
How are you? So what's your question? Yes. Oh, so are you near Elliott County?
Yeah, with Sandy Hook, Elliott County. I used to be an enumerator for the census. Oh. Now, as far as Lawrence, the last caller was concerned, you know, when you get your census form, if you fill it out and send it in, then that's the end of it. But if you don't send it in, we'll come by again and leave a call, knock at the doors, and have them fill it out.
Right. So Lawrence could have avoided some of those questions that he didn't want to be bothered with by just filling out the form. But do you, but just getting back to this Elliott County thing, can you guess what Elliott County is most famous for?
Well, a lot of the individuals stay in that county all their lives. If they move out of town to get work.
Huh. Interesting.
They go and they retire, and they come back, and they live in the same house
yes.
as their parents.
Okay, well, Krabby, let me tell you what actually the answer is, because it may be a little counterintuitive, and I was a surprised. It turns out that Elliott County, Kentucky, on average, has the longest commute to work of any county in the country. I think I read that properly. Did I not, Sam Roberts?
I think you did, Joe.
So Elliott County, Kentucky, I mean, we think of Los Angeles and being stuck in traffic or Washington or someplace like that, but how did that happen? Do you have any idea?
Where's everybody going?
Yeah. Or maybe they just have jobs that are way across the state. But, I mean, how do you... It must be a tremendous job of poring over these millions and millions and millions of bits of data to glean these somewhat interesting and somewhat outre facts.
Well, for one thing, I'm now wearing reading glasses as a result of that. I guess that puts me probably in a majority of Americans as well. And what I tried to do is make the book more of a narrative and throw most of the numbers in the back in tables and charts and graphs and things like that so that people could read the book and get a good feel for who we are as a country, who the people are. One thing that struck me in researching it toward the very end of the project last spring, Condoleezza Rice was testifying to the 9/11 Commission, and she said, they attacked us because of who we are. Well, I don't think they really know who we are. I think most Americans don't even know who we are. And we've also changed so much as a country from 1900, from as recently as 1950, and enormously in the 1990s themselves, that I thought it was worth this effort to try and get a much better sense statistically and narratively as who we are as Americans.
Well, why do you think it matters to know who we are? I mean, the census originally was taken up as a way of, you know, simply counting the people for the allocation of representatives to the House of Representatives. And is it important to have a better sense than that, or more knowledge than that?
Joe, I think it is. I mean, it is still mandated by the Constitution for that very reason. It's also used in lots of funding formulas by the federal government and elsewhere in terms of apportioning tax money. And I think it's very important in terms of public policy for us to know as best we can, not to the precise statistic, because I think that can be misleading, but just who we are as Americans, who's rich, who's poor, who's better educated, who isn't, how we differ in terms of race and national origin, who are the new immigrants and how they're doing. There's so many public policy questions about letting immigrants in, about letting them have driver's licenses, about are they a drain on the economy or a help for the economy. And these facts from the census help answer those questions, not necessarily give panaceas, not necessarily give perfect answers in black and white, but certainly help clarify a lot of those debates.
We have an email question here from Chris in Independence, Ohio, who's wondering, just to synthesize this question, whether there's any information in the census about gay and lesbian couples and whether they're included in the terms like family units, and if the research shows what number of gay and lesbian couples there are or families in this, what the numbers are like in this country.
It does. So, I mean, it doesn't say gay and lesbian per se, but it does say same-sex couples. Now, couples, you know, can be somewhat loosely defined, and it's a question of, you know, do you say that they are gay or lesbian or just two males or two females living together? For the most part, I think we can assume they are. They're probably undercounted in the census. The numbers are still very low in double digits as a percentage of all families, but you see them now being counted for the first time, mentioned in the book. That number clearly seems to be growing as much as anyone can quantify, whether it figures into the debate over legalized marriage or not. The number of people living together who are not married, who are of the same sex, does appear to be growing.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Kenny in, is it Paradise, California? Did I get that right?
You got it. Paradise,
okay.
Just above Chico. In the Northern California Valley, and about 100 miles north of Sacramento.
Okay.
Does Paradise live up to its name?
Yeah, it's beautiful. A lot of oaks and pine trees. We've got a mixed right where I'm living. But, you know, it's like anything else, any other place. The local politics is like, well, the other side, Hades, you know.
Okay. So what's your question?
My question is, and it's a dumb question maybe, but let's try it. I'm an old guy, 72 years old now. And I never married, and I wonder how I fit in the scheme of things throughout the United States.
Okay.
Well, you're in a minority.
I'm always in a minority, but yeah.
That's not necessarily a bad place to be.
I tell you, I've had a lot of married guys that said, boy, Kenny, you're lucky you never got married.
Okay.
well,
I'm not talking married, though.
Okay.
But I like to, yeah, how do I fit?
Most people do get married. As I said earlier, they're getting married later and later. Now men are getting married probably around 27. But there are more and more people in their late 20s, even early 30s, who aren't married. Yet, for the most part, they will get married eventually. Again, about half of them or so will get divorced. Many of those who get divorced will remarry. And if you're 72, that's a pretty good age to be living. And
life, I tell you, when you get old, I want people to look forward to life.
Okay.
And when you get old, it's great. It's a lot better than when I was younger.
Well, Kenny, as they say, you have to consider the alternative.
Well, that's true, too. But, you know, I mean, it's great. I want to live to 112 if I can.
Kenny, thanks very much for that call.
Listen, thanks a lot. I love your show. It's really great. It's kind of a pause from all this other politics we get on the talk shows.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Joe, I don't know if Kenny will live to be 112, but there are now, according to the census, more than 50,000 Americans who are over the age of 100.
Okay. I need to remind people that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, let's take another call, this time from Anne in Manhattan, New York. Anne, go ahead. And
hi, how are you?
Good.
I just was listening here to your program, very enjoyable, and I was just wondering, do non-citizens get counted in the census? And if so, why have I never been counted in the census? And if not, isn't that kind of ridiculous?
Wait a minute. You mean you're not a native-born New Yorker, Anne?
Yeah, I'm from Chicago. No.
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm definitely not native-born, no.
Okay, thank you. Sam, what about that?
Yes, everyone is supposed to get counted. Everyone who is living in the country full-time,
yeah.
Whether they're an immigrant, an illegal immigrant, an undocumented immigrant, if you're living here full-time, you should be counted or should have been counted.
Okay, Anne, thanks very much for that call. So where are we heading? You know, we've talked about the fact that we're aging. We've talked about the fact that there's more immigrants coming into the country. I guess we haven't talked about this, but your book mentions the fact that we're heading to the south and the west a little bit in general in population. But what else can we say about the future?
Well, that's true, Joe. One of the factors in this election, in fact, the South and West both gained 5 congressional seats as a result of the reapportionments in the 2000 census. We are getting darker in complexion. Hispanics now outnumber blacks in this country, and while not in the electorate, in the population. And that, again, has enormous implications culturally, politically. Non-Hispanic whites, as the census calls them, shrinking as part of the population. Not necessarily good, bad, or anything, but change. And by the middle of this century, they will probably be a minority in this country. Talk about minority. 20 million Americans identified their ancestry as Americans or United States. I think that's a healthy sign, again, showing a certain assimilation in this country. The biggest challenge we're going to face coming up this year and in years to come is managing all of this diversity, the diversity in the population by age, by color, by wealth. There's still extremes there, and income inequality keeps growing. And also in, as I said earlier, those priorities that different groups of the population will have. Someone will have to be in charge, our representatives will have to be in charge, and sort out those competing agendas.
Well, it sounds like an exciting time that lies ahead, and well, maybe we should settle it. No, we'll have to let somebody else do that. Anyway, I thank you, Sam Roberts.
Joe, thank you.
Sam Roberts is a reporter, columnist, and editor at the New York Times and author of the new book, Who We Are Now, The Changing Face of America in the 21st Century. He joined us from our New York bureau. When we come back from a short break, we're defining this year's political slang, swing states and being in play. What words puzzle you that you might have heard thrown around and wanted to know, hey, what are they talking about there? Send us your suggestions for 2004 inspired political slang words. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.